All right, here he is, the guest that you've been waiting for. In just a moment, John Hogue on Coast to Coast AM. Wherever I go, conferences, speaking engagements, I always get asked a question, who are your favorite guests on Coast to Coast? Well, we've got a lot of them, but one of them is John Hogue. John Hogue writes on the subjects of the occult, parapsychology, mysticism, prophecy. He's considered a world authority in Nostradamus, and of course, the best-selling author. And I'd like to say a dear friend of Coast to Coast. Hey, John, how are you?
Hey, how are you feeling? I hear you're on fire tonight.
I'm going to fight the good fight and let you do the show, and I'm going to sit back.
Well, you know how I'm rather verbose, so I hope to help.
If there was anybody who could bail me out tonight, it's you, John.
That's the first thing I thought of when I heard that you had a nearly 102 fever. I had that once in a hospital in India back in 1980, so I know what that feels like.
I hate fevers. I can handle colds. I can handle things like that. But when you get a fever, something happens to your body. And Raymond Moody's correct. I had the weirdest dreams last night as I was waking up in this cold sweat. I mean, you do. You get delirious, John.
Absolutely. I was laying in a bed where I felt like I was having a Raymond Moody experience. I was like out of watching this body shiver and convulse. And they were arguing outside the hospital. Well, he's got a really, we have too many people sick, and he's got to really be sick if he's going to stay overnight in this hospital. And I was kind of laughing to myself, thinking, I don't think I could even try to act sicker than I am right
exactly.
now.
Exactly. Exactly. Hey, what have you been doing lately?
Well, I've been very, very busy with putting together this new ebook. On the predictions for this very, very important year. And it, most of the time when I do HogueProphecy.com, where I have these every annual time around this time, I produce a three-part series on what's going to happen for the next year. But the this year that's coming, the year that we just entered, is so full of events all across the board of subjects for prophecy that I had to turn it into an entire book and called it Predictions for 2008. And it's posted online. Actually, there's a link on Coast to Coast to, that shows the introduces the book. Basically, I could probably go for 6-7 hours on all the things that are going to happen.
You believe that this year is more significant than that very magical year of 2012, don't you?
Yes, because it's sort of a, it's the beginning, it's the advent window of a number of great time clocks of prophecy, that is being the great grand procession of the equinox, which is shifting into a new cosmic month, which means this is the dawning of the age of Aquarius. This is the year where we cross the half-point margin between the overlap of the dwindling influence of the Piscean Age, which has been the last 2,000 years, and now we tip the scales towards feeling more and more the revolutionary, change-filled, questioning era of Aquarius. And one can see the fever of its new influences even in the political dialogue and debates that are going on in this very important election in America. Everyone is getting on the bandwagon for change, and change is the Aquarian age.
I think so, too. When you do the prophecy of Nostradamus, you also, though, have your own prophecy, don't you?
Yes. Most of these, especially in these books that I do once a year, these studies of the new year, I go out on a limb and apply some of what I've learned by studying so many prophetic traditions and applying to my own intuition to, although there's also references to Nostradamus and other things, other people in this book, I go out on a limb and make a record of it so that we can study how accurate it is and where it wasn't accurate. And perhaps, and this is a long lifetime study of mine, to leave a legacy of documentation to see what an ordinary human mind can do if that mind, which I, by the way, theorize that the gift of seeing the future, like so many gifts of the mind, are ordinary gifts that we view as extraordinary because our societies usually dull or suppress these natural tendencies in our consciousness. So this is another step in that process of seeing why we can see the future, what are the possibilities that make that happen, and when we get it wrong.
You know, and it's almost as if, and I would say it's not the Coast to Coast listeners, but most people in general don't understand how to tap into this, that same thing that you've tapped into over all these years.
Yeah, it's I've often encountered kids who were very small, who were in more open-minded families, that where a kid will say, "Yeah, well, you know, I had this experience, but when I was an old man a few years ago, and I lived over here, and things were like this." You know, like talking the time of day would be telling me about their past life. And I'd say, and I'd ask the child, "You were somebody else before?" "Oh yeah, I was just matter of fact." And usually, I think there's when those events happen to a lot of us in the normal existence of life, your parents, your pedagogues, your teachers, your authority figures early in life say, "Stop that, that's nonsense." Or, you know, usually the problem is that your need to be loved and to be fed and to have survival often makes one automatically, for survival's sake, drop those things that your parents or the people take care of you disapprove of because of cultural reasons, you know, conditionings. And that's the simple basic process that suppresses in us this innate genius, spiritual genius, that can also see the future, or see what I would rather say, see the future's potentials that are born out of present actions, individually and collectively. There's no rigid history waiting for us to be lived. It's constantly changing. In fact, as one speaks to a large number of people about certain issues, as we will speak tonight, we will, by just simply putting it on the table into the collective consciousness, be changing the future. Because people will listen tonight to some of the things I'm going to say. They're going to make decisions that might alter the course of history by who they vote for, what they do, etc. So it's a dynamic thing, and there's always the dogmatist. Or the professional skeptics that always try to cram one up their preconceived idea of the future, which is you're basically playing a mentalist guess game that, oh well, A, B, C, D is happening, and if those don't come true exactly as you predict, then you must be a fraud. It's just like saying, I'm saying apples, and certain critics say, no, it must be an orange. If it's not an orange, it's not real. But I'm saying it's an apple. And it is something that is not purely a thing of the objective mind. It is something that will at times use the objective mind, but it's also something of the subjective mind. I mean, it was wonderful to hear Raymond Moody, who was a big inspiration of mine when I was younger, was a major step towards my path to mysticism, trying to break out of the dogma that said there was only one life to live. Mm-hmm. And, you know, to hear him speak about logic and reason, and there may be a secondary step, a deeper step, or when he was talking about how you can get out of your own body and see a thing. Also, one of the callers was talking about trying to look at it beyond the dogmas of religion or soul, or looking at consciousness. Well, that's kind of on my path as well, and I try to experience the mind from a place that is not the mind. The theory is that something that actually can watch your past lives, something that it actually can, and I have come back from the near-death experience myself in an auto accident back in 1981, and it does change you. It expands. I mean, it's a terrible thing to happen to somebody, but if something positive can happen, it shocks you sure. out of your normal sense.
Absolutely.
And because of that experience, I've sort of had eyes in the back of my head, if you will, or eyes over my head, sometimes, and it's rather easy to be like that astronomer and look at myself as well as the star field as he is looking at his telescope.
Well, what came first for you, John, the learning the prophecies of Nostradamus that might have tuned you up personally, or were you already tuned up?
Well, I've always been a little strange, but my parents would say.
Welcome to the club.
Well, you know, it's like, I think that there are certain things that I look back in my life and I realize that these are rather subjective evidences, not objective, but subjective evidences that we carry things over from other lives, from other states of existence, at least, I'll say. And that kind of guided me towards the wonder of studying, is there more than just one life? Is there more than the existence merely now? And, of course, that naturally led me to not only the study of why we seem to be so repetitive and robotic in our lives, which led me to study history, which then led me to study future history, which is the history that's chronicalized by prophetic traditions, naturally led me to Nostradamus, who, if ever one goes into the process of studying the future, you run into Jules Verne, H.G. Wells, and eventually Nostradamus.
And I'm looking forward to this with you tonight, John. I think this program couldn't come at a better time tonight.
Yes, especially with such important decisions and history that's happening. What I think is so important with 2008 is that the history ticks like a clock. And in the cosmic calendar I was speaking of earlier, which is called the precession of the equinox, the tick and the talk, like a clock, the tick lasts 36 years, the talk lasts 36 years. The tick is a kind of assertive, masculine yang period of history where things are planted and sown. The talk is a kind of night, that's a day period, a cosmic day of 36 years, followed by a cosmic night of where we reap and give birth to the things that were seeded in the previous 36 years. We are entering cosmic night right now. And the things that are going to be, as with each of these tick-tocks, the initial year when the margin when it starts, decisions are made that will echo, for better or worse, for the next 36 years. And we are in it right now.
When you look at the significance of 2008, is it a good thing or a bad thing overall?
Overall, it's something beyond good and bad. Good and bad are values that we put on the consequences of conscious or unconscious action, individually or collectively. Something that can be a good action in the short term can end up, well, for instance, give an example, $150 billion to stop the housing market and give people some cash. But if that is another extra loan from China, then the thing that helps initially could end up being a bad thing later. I'm not saying it will be, but just to give you an example.
It could be.
The good thing that happened in the last cosmic day cycle, two cycles before this, the one that ended in 1936, was that in that period what was sown was a breakthrough in medicines that allowed so many children who died in childbirth or early childishness, child time, before they were mature, could live. And that's a good thing. But unfortunately, it also started this huge exponential population explosion, which we began reaping especially in the most recent cosmic night, which started in 1936 and ended in 1972-73 region. Then we went into cosmic day again. And that talk ended, and we were in the tick of cosmic day. And by that time, we suddenly had an overpopulation problem. So the rhythm of history is then here comes a new era where, okay, what can be seeded to solve that problem? What happened in 72, 73 is that mainstream government as well as individuals became more aware about ecological dangers. That's when it started. That's when the whole green movement began. That's when green parties began surfacing. Was in 72, 73. It was when President Nixon created the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency. Richard Nixon was a lover of Teddy Roosevelt, who was an early visionary of conservation, who was the creator of most of our national parks. And he saw this issue, and this is definitely a seeding that you see that kind of has now reached a 36-year period of fulfillment. Now we have presidents or potential presidents, both sides now, all sides in the political debate right now are talking about global warming, about a need to change the values and the very ways we live as Americans. And that is the reaping of what was planted in the past 36 years. For better or worse, that gives you some idea of how this tick-tock of history, almost say that history has a tick, a nervous tick, if you will.
Well, it does. It seems to me, John, that everything right now seems to be out of control. Everything. And, you know, tonight we'll talk about your thoughts on the Iran situation, the presidential situation. We'll get your takes, prophetic takes on that. And also after the break, I want to talk about the collapse of the housing market. But it just seems like everything is screwed up. Is that an accurate impression?
Yes, we're entering the chaos period for the next 36 years of an evolutionary crisis. And more than that, more significant than that, because this is actually the shift between two cosmic months. That's two periods of 2,000 years in this grand calendar that I'm talking about, which, by the way, is how you clock the vernal equinox retrograding or retreating. Every year it goes a little farther west in the sky as it goes through a line that draws itself through the tropical constellations, the 12 constellations of the zodiac. So a month lasts about 2,160 years. The last month, the month that we're leaving, was the month of Pisces, the age of Pisces. Now we're entering the 2,000-some years of the age of Aquarius. But so the day and night are 36 years apiece. But this progression takes 25,000-plus years to go through a complete 360-degree cycle. And that's called the cosmic year.
And here we are.
And here we are exactly at the point of the end of one month's influence and the new influence of a new month in the cosmic calendar. And in a shorter unit of time, we're dealing with a 36-year pulse or tick or talk, you know, of the rhythm of the clock. And so we are in for a very interesting time for the next 36 years. By the 2044, many of these issues that are just kind of coming in what William Strauss, who just recently died, but was one of I admired him as one of the finest futurologists out there. And I dedicated my book, Predictions for 2008, to him. And he called this decade, he's the one with a man named Howe who wrote The Fourth Turning, which looked at cycles, generational cycles in American history, and that we are now entering, since 2005, a new Fourth Turning, which is a 20-year crisis period. Last time we were there was during the economic depression of the 30s and World War II. Now we're back in it again, and he called this decade the O-O decade, as in, oh my goodness. I like to call it more the uh-oh.
Stay with us, John. Back in a moment. And our very special guest tonight, John Hogue. We'll be back with John in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. John Hogue, the housing market is getting slammed. 2008 could get even worse. What do you think?
Well, it's one of the most common questions I'm asked. Is the economy about to collapse? And my answer is an affirmative, absolute affirmative no. The housing market, of course, is going into recession. recession actually will affect different levels of and locales of the economy. For instance, if one's been in the book business like I am, we've been in a depression since 2003. So it depends on your job, your business that you're involved with. But the more important thing to state, and I state it very strongly in my chapter in predictions for 2008 called the World Economy and the Balance, is that we're probably heading for a recession, perhaps even deep recession in some sectors. But there's not going to be a depression, not at least for another 2 years. And there is the basic system that is built in the economy that, in as far as it plays its own rules, it makes its own rules. You know, one of the ironies of our system is that something that we often think is the most down-to-earth, non-esoteric reality is banks and bonds and dollars and you know, things that are really considered earthy issues are really based on one of the most abstract and imaginative things, that if enough people are convinced that a thing has value, then it is valuable. We used to, for thousands of years, deal with precious stones and gold and silver, and then when we got into modern times, we started making promissory notes towards these precious metals, and then we just shucked the present the metals and just started to think the notes were valuable. Then we started turning it into plastic cards. Then we now money is literally photons and electrons that go by the speed of light from one virtual bank to another. And what has remained a constant thread through all of that is that we believe, enough of us believe and play the game, that it's valuable. So it is valuable. Now, a lot of people keep asking me questions, and I get thousands of people writing me at talktome@hogprophecy.com, and I encourage it. All over the world, people write to me asking, well, you know, is China going to demand we pay our debts and then therefore collapse the dollar? I said, absolutely not. They can't, because the day after they do that to us, their economy collapses. Is the dollar no longer the preeminent currency in the world? Affirmative. Yes, that is finished. We have seen the end of the dollar as the sole world currency.
And you think that's going to change, John, maybe to the Amero, the thing we keep hearing so much about?
Well, I've heard about the Amero, but really it's going to be a play of several currencies, more like the euro and the U.S. dollar, and it's not going to, you know, it took 40 years for the British pound sterling during the last preeminent superpower, the turn of the last century. It took 40 years for the pound sterling to fade against the dollar. The dollar then was like the euro today. The dollar is probably going to take, I don't think it's going to take 40 years, and it also it has a lot to do with whether we get into wars in Iran or whether we get out of oil or things that are happening that will speed or slow the process. But between 20 to 40 years from now, the U.S. dollar will not be a world currency. It'll be one of the currencies, and there'll probably be something like the Terran or something. I don't think the Amero is really going to happen, I think, mainly because we're now going through another political cyclic change that happens every 36 years. It happened back in 72, 73, and it's happening again.
How did they screw this up, John? How did they let this happen?
Well, it's probably the problem has been for ever since the 80s. We have built America has always been that one of the unique contributions of America and civilization has been to create wealth out of nothing. And that has been wonderful. We, you know, up to our existence in the last few centuries, you gained wealth by invading someone else's country and taking their gold and their resources more than you did by just creating something out of nothing, innovating new ideas, and then convincing people of its value and then spreading the value. Now, the downside of that is that There's a lot of the shadow speculation involved in that. And what has happened is this rather inflated sense of value that has reached a point where this imagined idea can't sustain itself anymore. You have often people... remember what happened at the end of the 90s when the Congress was arguing how they were going to spend the windfall of all the money from the deficit being brought down, and then we suddenly were in the black, and everybody was fighting tooth and nail about how the next 20 years we were going to spend that money, and then a few years later it's gone. It's like everybody forgot that money didn't exist. But again, that's the power of imagination, which is the basis of our economies. And at a certain point, that power that imagination runs up against realities. Realities being that we have exponentially grown in our populations and our demands on this earth, and it's reached a point where this dream, economic dream, has to be altered. What's going to have to happen in the next 36 years is the world will have to come together, whatever their persuasion, and come up with a new dream and convince enough people of a new kind of wealth rather than a consumerist economy. In the next 36 years, we may see, starting with this year because of the crisis, a process that will lead to a more sustainable economy, something that values balance rather than excess.
Are there any candidates that you see this year that could do that?
Well, the interesting thing with the political campaigns that are happening is what I'm often seeing is something very classic to what has also begun. Actually, just a few days ago it began. So a very key cycle in astrology began. Pluto in predictive astrology is used as a force that, in the art of interpretation, helps one to see the collective unconscious motivations of whole peoples, whole eras. It's the demarcator of eras. We have just passed from the mid-90s or so into a era where Pluto has transited out of Sagittarius, which, of course, was punctuated mostly by its negative effects, which is religious extremism. We are now moving into Pluto's transit to Capricorn just as the major primaries are really getting involved, and it will only be there for 6 months. And then around a month after the elections in November, it stays for 18 years. And the last time, 248 years ago, that we were in this cycle was the era of the Age of Reason in Europe, was the first strong influence of the Aquarian Age upon the Piscean Age happened during the last 248 years. It's a time when individuals can share a vision to the collective and change the world. And I'm thinking of Thomas Paine, Benjamin Franklin, Jefferson, Voltaire, Rousseau, people who philosophized a new way of thinking, constructed a new paradigm. The positive side of Pluto in Capricorn transit is it's the construction of, with steady, diligent work, a grounding of our dreams in a new paradigm that's not just a flighty dream of the Age of Sagittarius. For instance, another example, long, long ago, 2,000 years ago, A mystic from Galilee had a dream in the Pluto-Sagittarius transit that we know as Jesus Christ. And he had a dream of his church being built on the rock of St. Peter. But it was the time of the Pluto's transit through Capricorn that church, that dream, could be brought down to earth, constructed, and made practically possible. And we have entered a period where our dreams and also our nightmares are coming into a period where they can be actually constructed into reality. So we have to choose between dreams and nightmares.
I'll take the dreams.
Yeah, me too. And the interesting thing about what's going on, what I hear there's often a lot of talk, actually a lot of demagoguery going on in the candidates. That means it's the Greek word for a leader who obtains power by means of impassioned appeals to the emotions of his audience, for better or worse. The slogan "Real Change" from one camp, or the slogan "Yes, we can, yes, we can." This is demagoguery. But beyond that, beyond the candidates doing this, there is an attempt that I have not seen in 36 years of an attempt to talk substance, to not just talk about dreams, but actually sit down. I've been watching the debates, and all in my years, I'm 52, I have watched, even since I was a kid, fascinated by politics, and this is the most substantive debates and discussions that I've ever seen potential candidates for president expound from all sides.
Will they implement, though, John, after they're elected?
Well, that is the big $64,000 question.
Seriously.
And the what I will say before getting into the details about who I think it may be or who are the top candidates who have a chance, the candidate that can take dreams and ground them, the candidate that can go beyond the easy path of simply being a demagogue and persuading people from their emotions, but can also make them think, is the candidate that is going to win this election. And the most amazing thing in this election is that we may very well see not only a woman and a black man, but also a Mormon and a Jew who have equal chances to become president of the United States, none of which have ever been close to becoming president of the United States.
True.
I mean, we have Hillary Clinton. We have Barack Obama. We may have Michael Bloomberg in March, who will join into the fray as an independent.
You think a dark horse might pop out, don't you, John?
Oh, yes. And there's Bloomberg, after I wrote that a few months ago for the book, it was surprising to find that Bloomberg is very seriously considering a run if he thinks that the front runners in the next month or so are not really inspiring the people, but just talking dreams and not substance. And I think that the potential in this, not only are we seeing the potential of these Republican and Democrat conventions actually being important, meaning that the races are so close that the delegates really do have to decide in their respective conventions in August for the Democrats, in early September for the Republicans, may have to actually decide. It may go that far into our future before we have a clear winner. If that is the way the pattern looks by March, I think that will pull Bloomberg off the fence and make a run as a completely independent, non-party-oriented campaign. And if he can communicate his ideas, he will outrun Ron Paul because he has the means, the money, the media savvy and connections to use his own money and jump into something, which is another important thing that I'll probably take more time later to explain tonight, is that we're entering with the Pluto Capricorn transit of the next 18 years.
What does that mean, Jeff?
Well, these longer than the beats and that I talked about in history. There's these astrological transits that define every 18 years. The nature of the collective unconscious of, what people collectively dream and hope for. And we are entering a period which I would call, for the next 18 years, the era of the executive. It's the era of the CE oligarchy. Now, the thing about prophecy is that there are things you predict that, in my case, I personally don't like, but one has to face the facts. For instance, I probably used this analogy before. If this was the turn of the last century and we saw the evil of the automobile that was going to change our horse and buggy lives, a lot of people in that time wanted to stop the automobile from happening. but it can't. It's just like people 100 years before wanted to stop the train, the iron horse, from happening, because it would change everything. And it did. Unfortunately, we are... Well, I don't know if I should say that's my bias thing, unfortunately. I have to look beyond my bias in this prophecy field and say that, you know, whether we like it or not, we have a new paradigm in politics that's beginning in 2008 and will be with us for the next 18 of the 36 years. And it is an era where CEOs, people of tremendous power and influence, are a power like a new aristocracy, a new royalty, that are a step above what people can vote into office. And to deny them or to think that you can destroy them or ignore them is to not face what Pluto and Capricorn really demands of us. Get grounded with your dreams and get practical and find ways to construct a solution that works and is for everyone's profit. The thing is that I see a situation where the people will still be voting, but they'll also need to learn how to vote with how they purchase. The new political arena is supply and demand in the era of Capricorn, which rules business, by the way, in astrology. It's the time of supply and demand, so the consumers have to demand things of the suppliers that will be more positive and beneficial as well as profitable for the world, and more life-affirming rather than divisive and pollutive and destructive. And already you see, especially you will see in this year, the rise of the green-collar worker and the green-collar entrepreneur. Capricorn rules entrepreneurship. This kind of business sense has to expand into ethics, into morality, into a lot of things. And not if it stays where it is, which is pure greed and consumption and short-term thinking.
Which is what we've had for a long time,
John. And what's happening is that's breaking down. It is breaking down big time. And already there are, it's almost like what I'm saying has an air of, if I were to use a metaphor, it's almost Ayn Randian. It's almost like Galt's Gulch and the story of Atlas Shrugged is that, you know, all the movers and shakers of the world threw up their hands and disappeared. And we're waiting to be invited back. Now, of course, one doesn't need to... deny that has a lot of dangers and the potential fascistic consequences. And that is one of the great dangers that faces us in the next 18 years is we're going to enter, if this is not done right, if people do not demand strongly enough, vote with their consumering, a better, more profitable way to make money and make wealth that is actually supporting human growth and love and these things as values rather than just pure, I'm going to grab what I can and consume as whatever I can, who cares. If we keep going on the old road, we're going to end up, by the 2020s, the whole world's going to have a number of what I would call emergency rule governments, which is another name for fascism.
Stay with us, John Hogue. We will talk about who you think might win the presidential elections, and of course the Antichrist. We always need to talk with you about that. Are we going into Iran? And what about this asteroid that's due to get very close to us in just a few hours?